Thank you all very much for coming. I'm looking forward to spending the evening with our panelists and all of you. So we have a very intimate crowd tonight, so be sure to weigh in if there's something that you would like to talk about. We have a few slides to go along with our Q&A this evening and some quotes here, and Mark was nice enough to locate this from John Wooden, the legendary college basketball coach. And before we get to the quote, I'll explain the picture. This happens to be my father, the man who raised me, and this is my little girl, Cameron, who is about to turn a year old next month. So this is my favorite slide, by the way, of the entire set. The quote reads, if you can't see it, I'll read here for you. It says, Dad was the best man I ever knew, the one who set the course that guided me through life, what I believe, what I do, and how I do it. In so many ways, he made everything happen, and he did it by teaching us in word and deed that the simplest virtues and values were the most important ones. A couple other interesting quotes we found that kind of range from very serious to rather fun. Sigmund Freud said, I cannot think of any need in childhood as strong as the need for a father's protection. And from Mark Twain, when I was a boy of 14, my father was so ignorant I could hardly stand to have the old man around. But when I got to be 21, I was astonished at how much he had learned in 7 years. How true is that? And from the president, we need fathers to step up, to realize that their job does not end at conception, that what makes you a man is not the ability to have a child, but the courage to raise one. Our panelists, we have a very distinguished set of four with us this evening, and we'll introduce them here, starting with Reggie Singleton, who is the closest to me. Reggie, for the past 15 years, has served as director of the Males Place in Charlotte, where he helps educate young men on male health and development issues, including anger management, paternity counseling, and pregnancy prevention. He is also a husband and father of three. So, Reggie, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Up next is Greg Hood. Greg is the Senior Vice President of Programs at Big Brothers Big Sisters of Charlotte, a program that provides positive adult role models to children as a means of helping them achieve their full potential. He also is the father of a 12-year-old son who in an email this week he told me was absolutely his best friend. So, Walker, correct? Yep, thanks for coming, Greg. The Honorable Ricky McCoy Mitchell has been a judge in Mecklenburg County for 11 years after serving in the county prosecutor's office. Besides her work in the court system, Judge McCoy Mitchell has worked on area children's issues through her church and also the Mecklenburg County Bar. And she has a very long and distinguished biography, so you are getting the absolute short sell on that. But she is very distinguished, and we're very honored to have her honor with us tonight. By the way, she is married and has one son and one daughter. So thank you, Judge. And Dr. George Batar is an assistant professor in the Marriage and Family Therapy Program at Pfeiffer University here in Charlotte. He's a licensed marriage and family therapist. He has a master's and doctorate degree, and one of his interest areas is integrated behavioral health in primary care settings. Dr. Batar is married. He does not have any children. So all of you, welcome, and again, thank you very much for coming. First question, Dr. Batar. How has fatherhood changed in the last half century or so? And was there ever a golden age for fathering?
Ooh, that's a great question. There's been a significant shift in not only what fatherhood means over the last 30 or 40 years, but really what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, the ideal structure to raise a family. There's a lot more single mother homes now. There's been a significant increase of those. And so in the past, you know, fatherhood meant being a man, meant, you know, being the breadwinner, providing for your family, being the disciplinarian. And there was some nurturing involved, but the emphasis really wasn't on the nurturing as much. And what's happened over the last 30 or 40 years for a lot of different reasons, you know, one of them is the women's movement, this movement towards greater equality between the sexes, is there's been this more fluidity between gender roles. And so now if you ask fathers, you know, what does it mean to be a good father, they'll say things like, it means, you know, being there, loving my child, nurturing my child, showing up, being there for the chores, you know, picking the child up from school. And so the languaging that fathers use now is much more nurturing, much more kind of attachment-focused, and there's still the breadwinner piece in there, but that seems to have kind of fallen a little bit more to the wayside. And the issues related to nurturing have come much more to the forefront. And that's a relatively new phenomenon. in terms of what it means to be a dad. And some of that's driven by economic issues. You know, it's become more important for both parents to work outside the home if it's a married home. And so you have mothers working full-time at a higher rate. And so within that's been this renegotiation of gender roles and who does what around the house. And so that's been one of the, you know, obviously significant shifts.
Has it been a change for the better in the last half century?
I think so. I think there's some mixed results in there. I think anytime you get growth, you get some side effects of growth. I think one of the growth pieces in that is that there's a lot more equality within a lot of marital relationships and in relationships in general. People are much more sensitive. Men are more sensitive to the role that they're playing in the house and more sensitive to being there for the little things with their children, picking them up from school, having the conversations, getting up at night to change the child. Little things like that in the past would have been looked upon as the father going above and beyond. And now it's becoming more of a standard, more of the norm. Now there's still a big discrepancy. If you ask fathers how much of the household work they do, they'll overestimate it. And so, you know, a lot of times it's still an issue. There's still work to be done. But I think overall it's a good trend because I think a lot of it shows it's a shift towards equality. But on the other end, you know, in terms of absenteeism and fathers not being present, you've had increases in incarceration and other factors, too, that have disrupted the household that maybe haven't been so good.
Mm-hmm. Another follow-up real quick. Mm-hmm. If you factor all of that in, would this be the golden age of fathering so far?
You know, I think that's a very debatable. I would say that the trend is moving in that direction. If the gender roles continue to be more, you know, like fluid, so dads and what being a man means continues to be more about nurturing and continue to be about strength, too, and all those other things, but also focuses more on male vulnerability and being more present and being connected and not being distant. I think that the trend is moving in a good direction in terms of some of these gender role issues and men being more present and showing up more with the day-to-day activities. So the potential's there. I think it remains to be seen where it ends.
Mm-hmm. Next question is for the judge, Judge McCoy Mitchell. Professionally speaking, some of the changes that Dr. Batar just talked about, how have they showed up in front of you and your bench?
As he was stating about the absenteeism and the trend toward that, that's usually what we're going to see, unfortunately, in juvenile court. I primarily preside in juvenile court, so that means I'm hearing cases that are in delinquency matters, criminal matters, involving children that are under 16. But it also means that I hear cases that are in the custody of the Department of Social Services, Youth and Family Services, which can go up to 18. When I see those cases come through, the majority of the cases, unfortunately, show up with young persons without fathers. And you can talk a lot about statistics and the impact of those and what they really mean, but I would tell you it's the story that makes a tremendous impact on you. It's the situations like you see where the mother's coming in and there are issues about delinquency, trying to get that young man back on track. And what she will tell me on occasion is, I can't teach him how to be a man. So that says volumes to you about the importance of that father, that male figure there, the role model. Or I'll see a young man coming into YFS custody kind of cases where he actually is the father, 15 years old, 16, actually have had 14-year-olds there. And we're developing what we call age-appropriate case plans. Those are plans that take into consideration what the age of the individual is. But when I look into his face and I'm talking about what's expected of them to be even on a track for reunification, if that's a possibility, and you see this face staring back at you, basically clueless. So you have a situation there where there was not a father or a strong male role model in the home or available to him. So how can he know what it's going to be like to be a father? And he's not had that same kind of involvement in his life. So from a professional standpoint, it can be very difficult when you have young people come in. And it saddens me when I'm having to say to a father, I'm glad to see you here. Even though I will tell them in that same breath, I expect to see you here. But it's because it's more often the exception than the rule that it becomes very challenging.
Reggie, if you were to see that young man, a 14-year-old who's been in trouble with the law and is also a father at that point in his life, knowing what you know and with your background, what would be the first thing you would say to him in a conversation?
Well, a number of these young men are referred to us. In fact, Judge does refer a number of those same young men to us. At 14, as much as you want to deal with fatherhood issues, because that is urgent, obviously, it's a reality. But as much as I would try to instruct him on the responsibilities of fatherhood and in terms of providing for his child and setting a good example for his child, I would also spend a whole lot of time on manhood development for him, because he's probably just a boy still. He may have the physical capacity to reproduce, and but in terms of having a clear definition in terms of what is now expected from him. And I think that those three traditional tenets of fatherhood, the providing, the protecting, and the guiding, still holds true. And while times may change, conditions may change, there may be some sociological transitions that are going on, I think those three things still ring true, still hold true. And boys need that, particularly the population that I work with, the African-American males, where in many families you may have as many as 75-80% of these young men where fathers aren't in the homes, and so there are no or very few models in terms of where they could model appropriate behavior that address and meets the needs of his child. So when that person first comes in, I will try to comfort him and reassure him that he can do it. And in spite of his age, I can see possibilities in that father and could see the potential of him being a good father. I think sometimes we think that people, that either you have it or you don't, you're born with it, but I think good fathers are made, they can be trained. And so he may appear to not have the prospects, but I think through training, through further socializing him and instructing him on those three basic responsibilities, but also on the more emerging aspects that Dr. Batar talked about, the taking guiding to a whole nother level, and the nurturing aspects of fathers, and particularly not just typical children, but even children with like special needs, that has even a greater degree of responsibility on fathers being involved. So absent fathers is one thing, but I think uninvolved fathers is just as bad, because he may be in the home, he may play golf all day, he may work 10 hours a day, doesn't get to see his children, doesn't help with the homework, doesn't help with bathing and reading, and may not have the conversations, and especially with boys, teaching them the importance of or modeling appropriate behavior and how to treat your wife, how to treat women, how to shave, how to fish, how to change car tires, how to tie a tie. These are critical, necessary socialization processes that boys must be taught. And when a young person who is 14, who's biologically capable of being a father, but he's not mentally and financially and spiritually perhaps ready at that time, it's going to require a lot of work. But I would not ever underestimate anyone. And certainly would have a level of expectation for that father, even though he may appear to not be the best prospect at that time.
Greg, let me ask you, and by the way, absentee fathering is something we'll spend a lot of time later this evening on, but Greg, I want to back up and make this a little bit more big picture at this point. Fathering in 2009, there's some research we came across. 61% of respondents to a poll said that their jobs, this is from fatherhood.org, by the way, their jobs as fathers today is more difficult than it was for their fathers. Is there some truth to that?
Well, I think that that's obviously how they feel, and I think that maybe there might be some for the similar reasons that Dr. Batard is saying. I think it's the roles are less cut and dry. You know, back in the old day, I think that they were pretty much the provider. more detached, things were simple. And then nowadays, the woman is working, the household responsibilities are shared, and the parenting is shared. So I think that, you know, a lot of men are very confused with their roles, and especially if a man was raised by a father from that generation, and that was his role model, was not being the nurturer, not being the one to get down on the floor and play with you. So I think there's some learning and some adapting there, and I think that's very difficult for some men to grasp.
How does a program like yours prepare young men to be better fathers when that time comes?
Well, I think Reggie mentioned role modeling. I think because we work with children from single parent families, 99% of the time it's the father that's out of the household, unfortunately, and they don't have that male role model. Judge McCoy hit it on the head. We hear the exact same thing. I can be a lot to my child, but I can't, especially my son, I can't teach him to be a man. So I think there's just things that guys have in common, whether it's good or bad. I don't know. We're guys, and we can provide things that women can't. Just maybe understanding what they're going through, understanding sports, understanding puberty, how we relate. You know, we're not as verbal as women. We're more, physical. We're more, just light at times. And I think that really helps an individual come into himself to gain self-esteem. And from self-esteem, those other things occur, like, you know, being able to be a good father, play on the floor with your child, be secure in your sensitivity, things like that. So I think it's all kind of same picture there.
And by the way, panelists, I'm pointing these questions at one of you, but if any of you have anything to say that you feel adds to our conversation tonight, yeah, jump in. So they're not just for the person that initially gets the question. And I would like to hear all of you weigh in on this one. We all go to high school, a lot of us. Some of us move on to college, and we get prepared for a career, and that's one of the most important things that we do in our life, but I think it would be hard to argue that if we are parents, that fathering and mothering isn't the most important thing that we do. But whose job is it to get us ready to be parents, and is there enough attention paid to being ready? You know, you mentioned being biologically ready, Reggie, at 13, 14. 15, whenever that may be, but we're far from ready emotionally. Whose job is it to get us ready to be good dads?
Well, historically, most societies have always set aside some time when they would pull boys aside or pull girls aside and teach them, try to inculcate them with the culture, the history, the teachings of their particular community, their family, their nation. Because they felt that, obviously, that is one way to ensure the future for them. That's one way you ensure that your people are going to be around for a long period of time. They're going to be healthy, and they're going to carry on their great traditions, et cetera. So it's there's a number of responsibilities there. Historically, we know that in the African-American community, there were four great pillars that worked collectively and worked in some degree of harmony, and that was the family, the church, the school, and the community. And they all shared that role, and we know now that they're in transition themselves, and so people are somewhat leaving the chance what happened to children, as well as the fathers. But I think primarily it is the parents' responsibility. But I do believe that there is a collective communal responsibility on behalf of the community as well. And I think absent parents or just uninvolved parents is probably our biggest problem in the country today. I think when you choose to bring someone in this world or you choose not to, or it's accidental or whatever, with no inclination to raise them, to have any appreciable quality of life, I think it's a sad commentary, and I believe it is one of our most pressing issue in our country today. So there is a collective responsibility, and I think that while the individuals may abandon their primary responsibilities, their families may, dads may abandon their primary responsibilities, I think there is a communal responsibility too. The great Italian poet Dante talked about how the hottest place in hell are reserved for those who, in a period of moral crisis, maintain their neutrality. And so sometimes silence is betrayal. And so when we see this crisis going on, and it's easy to say, well, it's not my child, and you know, that's the easy thing to do. And so that's why if parents don't do what they're supposed to do, that which is the primary socializer and trainer and provider and protector for those children, then I think as a community, we share a responsibility to ensure that these young people have a place where they will be raised properly. And that's why I think mentoring can be a powerful tool. I saw the mayor's mentoring alliance said that there were about 6,000 young people that was waiting to be mentored, and I'm sure Big Brothers and Big Sisters have an extensive waiting list. 100 Black Men have an extensive waiting list. The Males Place are looking for mentors. Reading Fathers are looking for mentors, I'm certain. The Men Empowerment. I'm sure that all of these churches, CMS, they're all looking for mentors and to meet the needs of young men who don't have involved men.
Dr. Bitar?
I just think that was beautifully put. That notion, I mean, we live in a very individualistic society in a lot of ways, and that notion that if it's not my children or not in my community, then it doesn't exist and I'm blind to it, and the harm that does. And so this is a huge, huge public health issue, this notion of absentee father. And until it's looked upon as a community responsibility and obligation that these are our children, not their children or someone else's children, these are our children, we're going to continue to pay for it in other ways through high incarceration rates and all sorts of things. I think that Reggie really captured that piece about that collective responsibility. Really, really nice.
I'm sorry, Greg, you come in on the communal end of it, where if there's not a father, there are others to step up. I would imagine, Reggie mentioned a waiting list. You don't have 6,000 men and women waiting to mentor young people here in Charlotte.
Correct. Our waiting list is about 500 of those 6,000, so that shows you the need right there. And it's difficult. It's a difficult part of the job to see kids come in the door and knowing that there's a good possibility that we're not going to be able to match them. I kind of echo Reggie's statement, although I would like to know what inculcate means. He have to teach me what that is.
I have a South Carolina education, okay? that just to repeatedly try to instill something in someone.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. You'll have to inculcate that into me.
Okay, all right.
but yeah, I mean, personally, I feel it is the parents' responsibility for the most part. But like Reggie said, church, community, all that. We can certainly take the village to raise a child, obviously. So,
Judge, you see a lot of these kids where it's gone wrong. How do you, if you could take a magic wand and back up and fix it, how would you do it?
Well, before I answer that question, I think I'm doing what we saw during different times as you go through politics and campaign. I want to answer one question. I want to answer first, and then I'll answer that one too.
Go for it.
But first question I want to follow up, because I think you heard a lot from all of the other panelists about the importance of realizing that these are our children. You know, there can be the one side that people will take a spin on it and say, if we don't help them, then these may be the children that end up in juvenile delinquency court because they robbed you or broken into your house or they've done all these negative things. I think that's sometimes an immediate response that people will have. The other spectrum I would have us think about is that we're losing such an incredible pool of talent.
Yes.
When I see some of these young people in court, and certainly there are issues that have brought them there before me, but once you hear from them, realize just how talented they are, and if they're given opportunity, which goes to your question, of going in a different direction, what major contributions they will make to our society, our community, and realize that these will be the people who are leading our community at a point. So it's incumbent upon us to invest. And if I could wave that magic wand, one thing I would like to go back and take all of the bad stuff that they've had to deal with in their life, whether that was at home or in the community or just at large, and deal with that. Not having that magic wand, what we've started trying to do, and actually some of you right here in the audience have been working with us, like Mr. Ratchford up here. I have to give him a big plug because he's been tremendous in looking at a special population who will be even more challenging for mentors than what we're looking at for big brothers and big sisters, and people that Reggie was talking about coming over to the male's place, and that would be the children in juvenile court, because I don't give up on them. They may have some more challenges. There's some other issues that get combined with that, but realizing that mentoring for them is crucial as well. I will often have young persons before me, and I ask, so where do you see yourself beyond today? What do you want to do? Sometimes you don't get a response, and that's scary. Sometimes you get an even scarier response. Well, if I'm alive, then you get responses of entertainment or sports. And I said, and the attorneys, and I even see several of them come in too, and they're talking, and they've bought into it, realizing we got to find another plan. Everybody's not going to be the next big NBA or NFL star, but you've got amazing talent, so what are you going to do with it? Well, I had a young man say, and I think he thought when he said it that I would just pass by it, not give it any credit, not move forward on it. He said, well, I want to be an architect. I said, okay. And fortunately, we have court counselors in court, or we may have social workers from Youth and Family Services. And I said, well, let me give you a name of a friend of mine who's an architect who has his own business so that you can go meet him, talk to him about what it took for him to get where he is. And I told him, you're representing me. Do not make me look bad either. So I expect you to go looking professionally. I expect you to act professionally and to take in what they're able to give you and use that. Well, a couple of months later, this young person came back into court on a review that I had set. And if you had seen the young person I saw the first day when I heard about I want to be an architect, and the young person I saw when he came back in after meeting that architect, being able to identify, it was a vision to be able to see themselves beyond where they are today. And then being able to get glowing reports back, because you keep your fingers crossed. You want the best. And I'm not so naive to believe that, even though I'd like to, but to believe that everyone that comes in front of you, you're going to be able to make that difference that you like to make. But I do believe that many of them can be in that situation. So when they throw out these numbers to you about the 500 and the thousands of them, it lets you know that you have a stake in this. Not necessarily it may be your child that's in court in front of me, or your child that may be in custody, or your child that actually may be walking on the street. But their lives are intertwined with our lives. And we can change the course. So I do believe I have a small one, not as big as the one I want. But I'm on a mission, and we tend to grab those as we go along on that mission.
Oh, I was just going to say that I agree with everything she's saying. It's neat to be in with Big Brothers Big Sisters. I've been there for 17 years to see this child come in as a 6-7-year-old. With issues and doing this and doing that, and pair them up with a mentor and just watch them improve over time. There's nothing more fulfilling than that. And again, I've been there for 17 years, so I've seen kids go through, you know, high school, go through college. I actually matched up a girl when she was 14. She had a lot of issues. She ended up having a great relationship with her big sister, went to Davidson College, helped us with our program at Davidson, and he graduated Davidson and even ended up working for us for a period of time. So that was, nothing was more fulfilling than that. And I can say firsthand, I mean, the reason I can kid Reggie is I've known him for 15 years, and he's been a big brother to three kids, right, at least?
Right.
Three. Yeah, none of them liked him, but but yeah, but and so he's got firsthand knowledge of change in children's lives. And this is a man with three children of his own. So, you know, so hats off to Reggie when you talk to him after the show.
Thanks, Greg. I appreciate that.
Very good. Let's switch gears for just a moment. We won't spend a lot of time in our next area, but it's one area that we wanted to address. And that, you know, those of us in the media, we're always cognizant of the impact that we have on others. And, you know, we in public radio we don't affect people, especially in this area, the way, you know, a television show or sitcom will. But that's where we're going to go next, is we want to talk about the way that media has portrayed fathers over the years. And we're going to look back at one example versus a more modern example. We'll start off with something from the Andy Griffith Show here. And this we're just going to hear some audio of Andy counseling Opie after the sheriff found out that his son had given just a very small amount to what Sheriff Taylor deemed to be a very worthy cause.
Now, look here, Opie. You can't give a little bitty piddling amount like 3 cents to a worthy cause like the underprivileged children's drive. I was reading here just the other day where there's somewhere like 400 needy boys in this county alone, or 1.5 boys per square mile.
There is?
There sure is.
I never seen one, Paul.
Never seen one what?
A half a boy.
Well, it's not really a half a boy. It's a ratio.
Horatio who?
Not Horatio, a ratio. It's mathematics. Arithmetic. Look, now, Opie, just forget that part of it. Forget the part about the half a boy.
It's pretty hard to forget a thing like that, Paul.
Well, try.
Kentucky accent.
And our second clip comes from another very long-running show, still on the air, in fact, that includes another very famous father. And this is Homer Simpson offering his opinion on, of all things, labor issues while sitting down with his family at the dinner table, and he's communicating here with his daughter, Lisa.
Lousy teachers trying to palm off our kids on us.
But, Dad, by striking, they're trying to effect a change in management so that they can be happier and more productive.
Lisa, if you don't like your job, you don't strike. You just go in every day and do it really happy. That's the American way.
So two very distinct examples of the way fathers have been portrayed over the years on television. And let's start with you, Dr. Bitar. Obviously, there's a big difference there between Sheriff Andy Taylor and Homer Simpson. Does that portrayal change the way that we father this year versus, say, 1960 when the other show began?
Certainly the media has a huge impact on the way we look at fatherhood and the way we look at manhood and womanhood and what it means to be a mom. And I don't know. I mean, I think that old image of Andy Griffith and being there with Opie and, you know, coaching him along and everything, I think a lot of those shows tended to be kind of purified in a lot of ways and didn't really deal with a lot of the grittiness of life that people have to go through. And so I think it's a little bit of a misconception to look back and see that really reflected reality. I think reality was very, very different back then, and maybe it wasn't talked about as directly. And then on the other extreme, you have more of a satirical, you know, kind of pessimistic view of fatherhood. But I think the images of fatherhood have probably become more widened as media. There's more media messages out there in terms of what a good father is, like the Cosby Show and other shows throughout the last couple of decades that have also portrayed, you know, maybe more of a realistic balance of what the realities of fatherhood mean. But probably the reality of fathering probably lies somewhere in the middle between Homer Simpson and Andy Griffith. So somewhere in the middle there. But certainly the media has a huge impact, and you can trace the media and changing attitudes about fatherhood and the way fathers are portrayed.
Judge, the way that the media portrays fatherhood, does that show up in your courtroom?
I don't think that the media's portrayal so much is what shows itself in court. It's more of a reality situation for the young people I see. It may be the neighbor that's down the street at the grocery store, not really so much the TV, or other friends that they may have, or someone else in the community, or not, the absence of that, or as Reggie was saying, the uninvolved one. But hearing from the young people in court has not been portrayed as much about what the media does, except in the light of what how the young people themselves are portrayed on TV is more what you would hear there.
Reggie, does the media's portrayal of fatherhood and the way we see TV dads interact with their children, does that make your job or Greg's job more difficult? Are we swimming upstream when we see Homer Simpson talking to his daughter Lisa the way he just did?
Yeah, I think the why they do it is beyond me. But fathers are viewed as idiots, as just clumsy dunts. I think of Al Bundy. You all remember Al Bundy?
Right.
Fred Sanford. that was clever. Okay. Just think about it tonight, all right? let's see. This is George Jefferson. And people portray them as just being idiots, you know, buffoons. And they laugh at these images of fathers. And it doesn't give... but I think those are the things that sells. You know, you have hardworking, legitimate fathers who are working, you know, full jobs and come home and do what's required. And these are the fathers we oftentimes don't see. There's nothing cute about that, about just working hard. And it's not, it doesn't sell, I guess. It doesn't carry ratings. But we know there are lots of just good, hardworking fathers. You know, they may not blow you away, maybe like a Barack Obama, who's a great example of fatherhood, but just good, hardworking, everyday fathers who love their children, who are instilling and are teaching their traditions. But, you know, we do need to, I think part of our responsibility in the powerful conference that was held last week in the Men Empowerment Conference. They dealt with the how we need to project positive images. And so a lot of that's going to come through us. It's important that we counteract these negative images with positive images because people become what they see. They live up to or live down to those expectations. And as we have expectations for people, I think people tend to rise up to them. If I could just add one other thing real quick. Judge referred a young man to me most recently, and she does a great job of preparing them to come to our program, our Males Place program. And she instilled in this young man that, look, you go there, it's a great program, and I expect this from you, and I expect that from you. And so he came to the program you know, feeling a great deal of responsibility to do right by Judge McCoy Mitchell. And it's important that children feel some degree where they want to do right for people, if not for themselves. They should want to do it for themselves. But so I think those are very important.
Greg, I'll ask you to weigh in on this topic. When you pair a young man, young boy, with a positive mm-hmm. male role model, is it often the first time some of these kids, not always, but sometimes is it sometimes the first time they've seen someone that's of the same sex that can be a positive influence in their life?
Absolutely. You don't like to think in those terms, but sometimes it is a reality, especially, I guess, the younger ones. And, you know, and that's vital for them because, you know, what that does is it opens their minds up and their expectations because they wouldn't know what else to be other than what they see. That's all they expect of themselves. That's all they know. And if they see somebody, like Reggie said, being a good husband, being a good father, being a good worker, being a good citizen, studying, you know, anything like that, that broadens their horizons and they learn what they could be.
We're going to switch gears again and go back into get into the absentee dads discussion a little bit more in depth. In the meantime, is there a question or two we want to get to before we get into that discussion, or should we just go right there? Yes, sir. We wait for a microphone so everyone can hear you.
I just want to ask the panel in general, as a single father, I've learned to redefine my role since my son was born and up until he's a teenager. And the fact that he has autism has given some additional challenges. But how do we, as single dads, define our role so we can give that to our sons or daughters so that we can pass on those new values to them.
I would first of all, just fantastic being as involved and as present as you are, and especially with the challenges of raising an autistic child. But, you know, I think some of it is not being confined by traditional notions, you know, if you're a single father, of masculinity. And so, you know, there's a, men are a lot of times socialized to pull back emotionally at some point. And so they can handle a level of intimacy, and then they tend to kind of disconnect or, you know, check out a little bit, or maybe, you know, focus on other activities. And so I think, you know, not being confined with those barriers that society tries to pass down a lot of times. And so, you know, being present, being vulnerable, you know, being emotional, I think that the one of the key pieces in, I think, good fatherhood is made in what might seem like the mundane, you know, the little day-to-day things. You know, the big trip once a year is absolutely fantastic. You know, but I don't think that's where good fathers are made. I think good fathers are made and good connections are made in that, you know, that 15 minutes after you pick up a child from school and you have this opportunity to process the child's day. And if you miss that window with the child, you may never get that time back. And so showing up for that time, that's magic in there. It may not seem like a lot to listen to a child process their day, but when you're present, when you're listening, children can feel that connection. And when you listen to the things that don't seem as important, it opens up a lot of opportunities and increases the likelihood that your child will come to you with things that are important. And so a lot of it is keeping that channel of communication open. And it's difficult. I mean, you're balancing as a single parent, you're balancing work, you're balancing you know, taking care of all the household chores, raising a parent. And so actually saving energy, it's easy to say, you know, save some good time, some of your best energy for your children. But I know the reality is it's extremely difficult to do that. But even if you can take, you know, 10 minutes after work and take a couple deep breaths and say, okay, now that I'm out of work, I'm going to be present here for my child, and I'm going to show up fully 100% for this next hour. And in that quality of time, I think that the children will really, they respond to it. They can feel it. Children are so intuitive, and they do so much from feeling. And so I think a lot of it is the time, that connection, the communication, and things like reading, you know, and those playtime are all very critical as well.
Greg?
I just wanted to chime in on this one, and again, I echo your sentiments because I'm a single father as well, so again, I applaud your efforts, and sometimes it's not easy. But I was thinking about this driving on the way over. I think especially with fathers who have had the primary family, you know, dissolve for whatever reason, what goes through their mind is, what do I do next? And they start looking at factors and things like that. And they tinker with being a good father or a present father as optional. I would just like to throw out a challenge and just say it's not optional. It is your obligation to that child. You brought them into this world. Despite the challenges, despite the obstacles, it is not optional. So that's the first step. Is it easy? No, depending on obviously your circumstances. But I would just like to say that I think, again, you hit on it, is those little moments. And as a matter of fact, Big Brothers, Big Sisters, our tagline is little moments, big magic. And basically what that means is, you know, is riding in the car, listening, being present, joking. You know, I told Scott, my 12-year-old son is my best friend, and that's exactly why, is we just talk. We hang out. We do big stuff. We do little stuff as well. It's just we're friends. I mean, am I a parent? Absolutely. And he knows where dad starts and friends ends. But I think one of the reasons that, I mean, he's an exceptional child just because, and again, it's not all my fault. He's been a great kid. I mean, not all my, you know what I mean, not all my responsibility. He's been a great kid since day one. But it's the respect. You know, I respect him as an individual. I listen to his ideas as an individual. And he in turn respects me. So it's cyclical. I mean, I equate it almost to the army. You get out of it what you put into it, and that's true. The more you put into fatherhood, the more you get out of it.
So.
Very good. And by the way, at any point this evening that you folks have a question, we have two mic runners. Aaron is walking down the steps right now, and Marshall here. So get their attention, and I'll every now and then turn around and hopefully scan. And if I don't see you, just have these guys tap on the mic. Go ahead, sir.
I was adopted, and I was raised by parents. My father was born in 26, so he's part of a distant generation who didn't know what it was like to, you know, be affectionate and all these things that were stated up here. However, at, you know, 44 years of age, I realized that I never knew my father the way his friends or even his students, he was a teacher, knew him, or even his military buddies knew him. And so with my own kids, I have six kids who range in age from 5 to 17. And one of the things that I had to say to myself was, just riding off of what you just said with regards to, it is our responsibility as fathers. Fathering isn't who you are, not just who you are, but it's what you have to do. You know, it's like love. It's more than a feeling. It's an action. And fathering is an action. And I think as an industrialized society, when you watch some of these National Geographic programs where you've got these indigenous people off somewhere in deep Africa or wherever, and it seems like in some of these situations, they got the fathering thing down pat. They're telling the stories. These kids know who their father is, who their grandfather is, and so on down the generations. But not only that, they have a defined period in which a young man goes from being a boy to being a man. And that's something here in the U.S. we've lost. We've completely lost it. And so with my own kids, you know, I hear a lot of talk about time. You know, I put a lot of time into my kids because regardless of what my business card says, my greatest role is dad, period. The business card is, that's the thing that I do during the day so I can provide for my family. But my identity is father, because when I walk through the door, I hear daddy. And I work with a program called A Father's Place at the Pregnancy Center here in Charlotte. And one of the things that I try to do with these young men there is help them to understand that there's a greater vision in terms of who you are as a father. You know, 50 years from now, you can look back and see the impact that you had not only on the ones that you're raising, but the ones that they're raising that you, as pappy, built into, you know.
Let me interrupt you. Congratulations, by the way, on your children. And that's one thing I'm getting used to now as a father of an 11-month-old. Who I am has been defined by a husband, maybe what I've done for a living since I've gotten out of college. Now it's I'm a father because I work at a public radio station for 8 hours a day, but I'm a father for 24, so I can identify. Let me ask you, you're here. You obviously have an interest in our topic. As those of us who have been fortunate enough to be dads at this point in our lives, is it, just a quick show of hands, is our most important role in life to be a father? Husband more than a father, okay? For those of you who aren't raising your hands, just shout out real quick, what's more important than being a father? There's a difference. Okay. Reggie, why did you say being a good husband's more important than being a father?
well, because I think, as I said earlier, when you love your children's mother, I think that's one of the greatest. That teaches children, it provides the children the safety, the security, predictability that things are going to be okay, mom and dad is okay. You know, they're not fussing and arguing. It teaches them that everything's safe, you know, and so it helps keep the home peaceful. So it would be in that order. It would be wife and then children. Yeah. If I could just add one other quick thing, too. I want to say bless the brother who's raising the single parent up there. And I'm amazed at what single parents are able to do. You know, I too have a son who's autistic, and he's 12, and I know the challenges of just typical children, but children with special needs, some of the special challenges they present. So it's real tough work. And again, being a father, while it is certainly the most one of the most rewarding things, it is one of the toughest responsibilities I think you could have. It's very hard work, too.
Absentee dads, we'll start this discussion, or continue it, I should say. You can see up here, 24 million children, 34%, live in the absence of their biological father. 40% of kids in absent father homes have not seen their father in the past year, and 50% of children living absent of their father have never been in their father's home. So obviously this is something that a lot of kids deal with as they grow up. Dr. Batar, just from an academic standpoint, for those of us who don't have the expertise level in this area that you do, why is attention from the father, the male, so important to a young person?
For the young person, it's there a lot of times a sense, another parent, a sense of security. I think one of the biggest issues when a father leaves that's really significant, there tends to be a dramatic decrease in the household income. And so, and when that occurs, then all of a sudden you don't have the same access to healthcare, you don't have the same access to the education as other families might. Mental health suffers, physical health suffers. There's poor school performance. People tend to live in more dangerous neighborhoods at that point. And so a lot of it, some of it is a function of a two-parent earning house, having two incomes. But the other piece is that, you know, it's tricky. I mean, are there things that only, you know, a male can provide? And it's a very difficult and delicate issue in a lot of ways, because there are women that have traditionally very masculine traits, and there are men that have traditionally very feminine traits. And so, can the woman with traditionally masculine traits instill the same sense of masculine energy or value within the child as anybody else, as a biological male? And so, it gets a little bit tricky in that sense, but in terms of that connection, not just for sons, and we tend to focus on, you know, the father involvement for sons, but also for daughters, and for fathers to be able to train daughters up in things that are stereotypically male things to do, playing basketball, changing the tire, for fathers to really get involved at that level with their daughters as well, and not look them over. It's interesting. Fathers tend to focus more on how to raise their sons as men rather than how to raise their daughters as women. And I think that hopefully that's shifting some, but that's an area that's often neglected. So father involvement is absolutely critical. There's the income piece. Then there's the energy piece, having two sets of hands in the house, and everything is absolutely critical.
For Judge McCoy Mitchell, if you could just roughly estimate of all of the young people that come before you who they're there because they're obviously in trouble, do you have any idea, is there a sense of background that you can get from them that how many of those kids are being raised absent of a dad?
I don't think that children I'm seeing, they're much different from the statistics that you have here, except sometimes depending upon whether it's delinquency or YFS or Youth and Family Services, it could actually be higher on the young people that we're seeing here. I do also want to back up, and I think there are a couple of comments or shows of hands out there about the importance of being a good parent, and when we're talking about a father, being a good, positive father, because there are also situations we see where a father is in the home, but it's an abusive situation. There may be domestic violence involved. There may be substance abuse issues. So it's making sure that it's a positive influence that's involved. But as far as the presence or absence, it's probably higher than the statistics that we see here. What was real interesting is some of the cases we saw where young people had already been diagnosed to have things such as the oppositional defiant disorder you see oftentimes, and sometimes the ADD or ADHD, depending upon the time frame when it's come in there, or defiance, focus on that. You would also see in a couple of the situations where the young people had come in and the father's lessening involvement with the family also mirrored the worsening of the behavior that was involved, which could certainly be the same way with a mother or another parent. But you saw a very close connection between that and how the behavior worsened when the father started spending less time at home or became completely absent at that point. So we do see, unfortunately, the higher statistics of the absenteeism or the negative influence involved. Not always, but it's a higher percentage.
I'm sorry. Greg, are most of the kids that you see, in fact, being raised without dads?
Yes, absolutely. Yep.
Overwhelming majority?
Yeah, about 99% of them.
Really, is that correct? Wow.
Yep.
Reggie, I'll ask you this question. It hasn't always been commonplace for men not to be a part of their children's lives, but what has changed over the, I assume, decades, I think for the scope of our conversation tonight, what has changed over that amount of time that has made it an accepted or acceptable practice?
Well, certainly the economy has changed, the need for more mothers to be out of the home. And we know in many communities, though, with many populations, having someone at home weren't afforded that opportunity to have that kind of arrangement where one parent is home with the children. But the economy certainly has changed. Technology and information has changed. There are new things that are introduced to society, and some people may see these as advancements. You know, I'm not sure that things, just because it's introduced and it seems to be cool and seems to be hip, that it's necessarily a true advancement. I think again that there are some traditional things that I think it's important that we hold on to and not be so readily willing to just forego. I don't think our four parents were as stupid as I think we'd want to think they are. I think there are a lot of people who get it. Some don't. And there are some things, even though it's new and all, revolutionary and all, there's still some things we could use, and there's some things that we still can't use. And as a parent, one of the things that when we talk about protecting, well, it's not only protecting when a burglar comes in the house, but also protecting, who teaches your child, and teaches them what? What are they exposed to? What music are they listening to? What TV are they watching? What ideologies? And of course, you want them to broaden their horizon, to be exposed to new things, but there are some things I think that we need to really be mindful of what people are picking up and run with it, and trying and sampling this and trying and sampling that. And there are some things we can use and there are some things we can't. And I think children really, the kids I work with, they really want to know where they stand, what are the boundaries. They want discipline, they beg for it. And when you give them some structure, they tend to do a whole lot better because they really want to please you. I think they really want to please you. So it has changed, but those primary things, those will never change. I think, again, if the question again is, what is the best condition or how do we best raise children? I think that always has to be our question, and it should always be our answer as well.
We have a question. Marshall, stand by with the microphone. There you go.
I'm curious if the panel could discuss the impact of maybe a negative relationship between a mother and a father, and how that plays a role in maybe fathers not being as active in their child's life. I have a lot of friends with a wide variety of experiences and involvement in their children's lives. It tends to be often that it's something that, you know, between the father and the mother more so than the father really wanting to have a relationship with their child.
Who would like to tackle it? Dr. Bitar?
That his priority is being a husband first, you know, and that kind of quality, I mean, that sets the tone for the household. I mean, if you walk into a house and you're there with a couple, I mean, you can feel pretty quickly, like, you know, if there's some sort of tension or there's something underneath the surface there, and children can feel that too. And so if there's, you know, a lot of conflict within the couple relationship, and that's a variable in pushing the father away, then certainly, you know, addressing that piece. But, you know, and it's a great point because it brings up this whole interconnection thing, that this family is this kind of living organism in a lot of ways, and you can't just focus on one piece while the other piece is unhealthy. And so it's hard to really be a great dad or a great mother if the marriage is just suffering. And if you're arguing all the time with your spouse, it's hard to build that kind of safety within the house. And so part of being a good dad is being a good husband. Part of being a good mother is being a good spouse, a good partner. And so looking at it more kind of wholly like that and more fully is absolutely critical. So that's, I think that you bring up a fantastic point there.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, next question.
Hi. We talk a lot about 80% of families that you're dealing with have an absent father. How do you teach the girls that that's not the status quo and that they should not accept that from any of their young partners, and they should start to revise expectations upwards from the ground? And are you taking any steps to provide healthy fatherhood models to these young girls so that they know that there is an alternative?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think fathers fathers do a great job and really need to be involved for their daughters as well, because it gives them a level of expectations in terms of what a man or a date should be like. It gives them a sense of normalcy, how she should expect to be treated, particularly by how he treats the young lady's mother. You know, I saw a study years ago that dealt with pheromones, the smell and the aroma that people put out, animals, etc. And they talked about how when a father is present and involved, that somehow females tend to go through puberty appreciably later, that they don't feel the need to have to grow up as fast by the presence of the father. And so by just physically being there, there's great value in that. But I remember going to do a presentation at a middle school here in Charlotte, and I was talking with some of the young ladies in the group, and we were talking about Rihanna and Chris Brown, what had happened, the domestic violence and abuse, dating violence that went on there. And a number of them, in fact, the larger majority of them, said that they thought that Rihanna was deserving of what she got, that that Chris was justified in doing what he did to her. You know, and so you're absolutely right. It's not only the boys, but we got to do an incredible amount of work with our young ladies too. And you know, it's been said that, you know, women are our first teacher, and if they're the first teachers, or historically have been the first teachers, it's important that we provide positive images, self-assured, assertive, confident women, you know, that they see those images, and that we, through our institutions, through and not just seeing women as just pretty and dumb, you know, as if they're just a trophy or a piece of meat or whatever. So it's important that we do a lot of work with women as well.
Hi, I'm a family physician, and just as a side, you're talking about most important role. My daughter's name is Mira, and for the longest time, she thought the MD after my name stood for Mira's daddy. She just figured it out. She's now 12, and she's figured out, I don't think that's really right. There's other people with MD around, and they're not. I work with a predominantly under-resourced population, so it's very common for me to have lots of patients whose fathers are not present, and also do prenatal care for, and I usually ask the question, is the father going to be involved? And usually, more often than not, they'll say, no, they're probably not going to be involved. I don't have any relationship. And I'm you know, I've sort of been very patient-centered and just sort of allowed that to happen and just sort of just acknowledge it and say, there's not going to be a father at the delivery. And then I'm listening tonight and wondering if that's the right response, you know, and how to, you know, it's, for this person who's absent to me too, how do I encourage that involvement? We've kind of let that happen, and I'm just sort of putting that out there for all of us. It's more of a, not as much of a question as a comment. And what, you know, you talk about our responsibility as a community. How do we make that happen?
I mean, just it's kind of the sad acceptance of the status quo, and I think it's difficult for different systems. You know, as a family therapist, when the father's not involved, you know, how do I engage that piece, that critical piece of the family? And I think the point is dead on. You know, how do we as different professionals and within the community actually not just accept the status quo and in so doing kind of be complicit in maintaining it? You know, how do we engage fathers and bring them back in? Is it that conversation, getting the release of information and talking directly, or, you know, what does that look like? So I think it's a wonderful question.
Mm-hmm. And I think that was a clear example of what we need to do, and that is be intentional in thinking about it. Because maybe even before this program and having the discussion among us, we would just go along with how things were. You certainly have to be careful about the dynamics involved. So never to suggest that you automatically would expect a great relationship, because it might not be a great relationship. There may be dangers of domestic violence or other issues involved, so you certainly have to be very careful of it. But part of it, even as judges for us, is to be thoughtful. That maybe this is a situation where you can raise that question. And that is a great first step of being conscious and then intentional in moving forward.
Yeah, and I personally just think that we need to raise the awareness of the issue that we're talking about in forums like tonight. Media would certainly help. And I agree that we've accepted it. And so if we, you know, take on some personal accountability, just to kind of put it out there that how important fathers are in child's lives, how important, you know, marriage is, being a good husband, being a good father. And to this gentleman's point up here, is to even educate the mothers of the children to more easily facilitate the relationship between the father and the child, because that is a factor that drives the father away, unfortunately. So there just needs to be more awareness, more intentionality, you know, and that's a societal issue.
I could just share real briefly some of the feedback I've gotten from some of the fathers that I work with and young men. Many of them talk of or speak of them not always feeling welcomed, or the environment might not be very male-friendly. You know, from the walls to the painting to the colors to the music to the magazines. Or the brochures might not necessarily be as inclusive. I had a young man who told me that he was actually married. This was his wife, that he was in the labor and delivery room, and he felt he was being treated like a boyfriend, like the nurses kind of received him as a boyfriend. And so I think as a community and certainly as professionals, I think we can do all we can to make our environments more inclusive. And more responsive to males. Again, magazines are wonderful, and not that we're all just cavemen, but I think it's important that they feel as if they're welcomed, and also offer perhaps other services that like breastfeeding, you know, where we where males have some knowledge in terms of how they could contribute and. Not contribute, but assist, you know, assist with the whole breastfeeding process, you know, bringing the baby to the tired mom, you know, warming up the bottle, you know, getting up, you know, bringing the baby to her, those kinds of things. And so there are some things I think we can do as caring professionals as well, too. But certainly males, we need to do a better job in terms of having people to expect that partner to be there. Yeah.
How many of you are familiar with the reality show John and Kate Plus Eight?
Wow.
Several of you. Okay, quite a few of you are. Millions of people are watching that right now. And if you happen to see it the other night, my wife watches, which means I watch on Monday nights until the fall when football season starts, and then I'll go to another TV. But John, the husband who's 32, who's had eight kids since he was 26 years old, I believe, has decided that he essentially, at least from my take on watching it, that he needs an escape, that he's going to leave. The husband and wife are divorcing, and now he has five girls who are, I think, age 8 and 5, who will now be living without their dad, and three little boys who are age 5 who will be living without their dad. If you as panelists could sit down with John one-on-one, what would you say to him, Dr. Bitar?
I think one of the things I would focus on first is getting a good communication channel opened up between the two spouses, or, you know, John and Kate directly, and emphasizing the importance of that divorce, why it's going to be painful and it's going to be difficult. There's going to be a lot of tears, that it can also be a transition that doesn't really damage the children. Surely there's going to be some implications of that, there's no question, in terms of those attachments and not having the stability and the patterns and everything, the environment they were used to for the children. But I think that we talk about divorce as being this traumatic thing, and it is a traumatic thing, but it can also be less traumatic. And I think I would focus on making this process less traumatic, bringing in a third party potentially. I know therapists are working more closely with lawyers at the onset of divorce proceedings to make that transition easier, so parents can still, because they're still going to be parenting together. They're still going to be either on the same page moving the children in a good direction, or they're going to be undermining each other and undermining the children. And so they're never going to be out of each other's lives. The relationship is never going to end. It's going to continue. And so since that's the case, how do they work together to still provide a level of structure, a level of stability, a good model of how you treat other human beings, you know, not talking bad about each other behind the other's back, not undermining what the other person does? And how do you ensure that both parents can have access to the children at a level that's best for the children? And it kind of goes back to Reggie's question earlier, you know, what's best for the children? What does this look like? Not what's best for the parents, but what's best for these kids? And I think I would emphasize that and get another party involved, probably because the tension, I imagine, is probably so great they probably can't negotiate a lot of that by themselves. But knowing that divorce is going to be difficult, it's going to be horrible, but it doesn't have to be something that it can be less damaging, it can be less traumatic, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Greg, I don't want to put you on the spot, but knowing what we know about your situation, you mentioned in an email that your son Walker lives with you at halftime.
Half the time.
Okay, how have you made it work?
Well, that is very personal, but that's okay.
Say as much as you're comfortable saying.
No, I understand. Anybody who knows me, I'm pretty open. Yeah, Walker's very young at the time, and you know when we decided to split up, I think both of us at the same time, basically very early on, realized we accepted it, and our goal was to do what was right by Walker. And he was our first priority. So what we did, and God bless, you know, my ex, I wanted Walker at least half the time, and she wanted him at least half the time. So we came to an agreement that that's what was best in best interest of Walker. And so he now has two loving homes. He is a very well-adjusted child, and we work well together. I never bad mouth her. She never bad mouths me. We're a team. Somebody said we're still very much a team. We just have different dynamics. And I think it's all about, again, just putting the child's best interest at heart, spending time with them. You know, fatherhood is still, you know, my top priority because I'm not a husband anymore. So, So it's just a mindset. And again, it goes back to this gentleman's point. You know, she made it very easy for me because she understood how important I was to Walker and Walker was to me. So I think it all, you know, I'm not advocating divorce, obviously, but in the worst case situation, you can minimize the trauma to the child.
Real quick, are we getting better in these situations? Divorce rates are not going down, as far as I know. So we have a lot of opportunity to perfect how to be two household parents, if you will. Judge, are we? Is there a role there? Is it something, an opportunity we can explore? Can we perfect doing exactly what Greg just said, or are we still kind of stuck at the father's role? Once he takes off, he's gone.
If you have people that can do it as well as they're doing it, and you have to do it, then certainly you want it to be the least traumatic that it possibly can be. I think the law has finally gotten around to it, maybe not as good as we need to be about it, but understand that there are things like collaborative law, is what we call it, where it becomes less litigious, because you probably are familiar with situations, if you've not already been in one of those, where friends or maybe even you or family members have been involved in very hotly contested custody cases or less than pleasant divorce situations. Excuse me. And even the law has realized that sometimes as lawyers controversy and attention can be fueled by the involvement and the approach that the lawyers can take in it and the courtroom setting. So there has been even a movement to make that less adversarial and try to work out situations that are in the best interest of the child and the least traumatic for everyone involved. Making it perfect, I think we still have a ways to go on.
Got about 10 minutes left and a whole lot of hands here, so let's go to where the microphones are here.
Hey, my name is Seldrick, and I am a member of Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity, and we have a partnership with Big Brothers Big Sisters. We also have brothers within our chapter that are part of 100 Black Men, and then I think I've heard about 5 or 6 other organizations within the room. And what I find is it's difficult sometimes as an individual where we may have persons that are fathers helping out with the absentee dads, and the statistics are what they are. We understand there are not a lot of dads in the home. Each one of our organizations are looking for mentors. Charlotte is only but so big. So how do we encourage other people? Because sometimes it feels as an individual that if you're not a part of my organization, if you're not a part of Big Brothers, Big Sisters, if you're not a part of 100 Black Men, then you don't have a place in that community and raising that child is a part of a village. So our own organizations become exclusionary. So how do we encourage other persons within the community to be a part of that movement and be a part of making sure that if it's not your biological father or part of your family, that we still have enough mentors within the community to address the needs?
Well, I think that was a great segue into my push about appropriate training for mentors to be involved. And it sounds pretty simple about the each one, reach one approach, but it actually can be very impactful. Because I'm looking for more specialized mentors for young persons in juvenile court, and I've talked to the Alphas and the Kappas and the Qs, and I've talked to the 100 Black Men and a lot of Big Brothers, Big Sisters, a lot of different programs. But again, all of those programs are, as you said, are still looking for other mentors. And in situations like with juveniles coming from court, are not really the first young people that you would necessarily look to because they would be more difficult. But I think that you set an example. I talked to many members in the faith community, and there really is a groundswell of people who want to do something. The difficulty is they don't know what to do. The way that Dr. Vitar was talking about being fluid is the same approach I think that we need to take in our community, within our different organizations, agencies, and not being territorial about any of it, but that these children need a mentor. And it doesn't matter what fraternity, sorority, agency, other group you're involved in. Let me reach across my organization, talk to my church member, talk to someone I work with. I talk to actually people I may meet out at another event. This is what we're doing. We know that there's a need, and let me tell you how you can help fill it. And I will tell you that if you talk to another young man, he would be more likely to be willing to step out there and try it than if I come and say, why don't you consider being a mentor? Because you come with credibility. And I think that that makes a difference in encouraging other people to do it, because people know there's a need. That's not something we need to be here and say, there's a need for it. But people want to know, what do I do? How do I do it? And with whom do I connect to get it done? And so what we've been trying to do is through like these court committees and through your own organizations is bring other people together, because there are going to be people who are not necessarily involved in those particular organizations but are still interested, and you become the voice and encourage them. And then we become resources. You get the people. I'm sure that between all of us here and others, we can find children that they can mentor. So that simple approach that I'm talking about of each one reach one really does work, because that one you reach then can reach someone else and bring them along, because they'll come with you even if they wouldn't come with me.
Reggie, real quick.
I would just add that, you know, a lot of times we look for the traditional community match, which is one-on-one, and that's what everybody's looking for, but they're obviously, that's the most impactful one, too, because you it's a one-on-one over a long period of time. But group mentoring can be powerfully impactful as well, too, and we do such a group mentoring. That's very important. And the initial question about parents, I think parents need not feel as if they have to have all of the answers necessarily, but lean on older adults, godparents, forming support groups for their children and loved ones. Those can be powerful too, and not only give you respite, but allow you an opportunity to recharge too. So, and I think as parents, we all need to be able to do that sometimes.
Next question.
I'm a family practitioner. I do nothing but represent minority fathers and other family members. I don't represent mothers. I've handled 500 cases, custody cases in Mecklenburg County, so I know about what I'm about to say, and I want to explain why the dads aren't involved. The dads are not involved because the mothers will not let them be. The mother, and I need to clarify this, we have been talking all evening about divorces. Everything that you have had to say is valid about divorces. The majority of children being born are being born out of wedlock. There is no relationship between the mother and the father for the most part. Nevertheless, the father wants to be a part of that child's life, and the mother does everything in her power to keep him away from the child. She will not allow his name to be on the birth certificate. The reality of that decision is that should something happen to the father and he's killed in an automobile accident, the child doesn't get the father's death benefits. If the father is involved in a work-related injury and he's going to be on disability the rest of his life because the father's name is not on the birth certificate, the child doesn't get the benefits. The mothers will go so far as to not allow the father to provide child support because they link child support and visitation, which are not, those are two separate things. The mothers will go so far, and I say this so passionately because this is my passion, are these dads, because these kids are being deprived of something essential to their success. I was undergoing chemotherapy some years ago, and in 1 week's time, I was running a nonprofit clinic. I had six fathers come to me and tell me that they wanted visitation with their children. They had offered the mother the opportunity to put the child on their health insurance, and she refused. So what I would like everybody who's here to go out to the community and to tell the dads you have equal rights. We have one of the best family law, family court systems in the state. We have five extraordinary judges who look at what's in the best interest of the child. They do not automatically assume that it's going to be the mother who can provide the best for the child. They look at two things, what's in the best interest of the child and which of these two parents will better foster a relationship between the child and the absentee parent. And many single moms who have kept that father at bay have lost custody of their children because they would not let the father be involved.
Okay. Let's go two more questions.
Well, thank you for saying what you say. I guess I don't know where I have been, a single dad, a divorced dad. What is that, an absentee dad? I have all through my mind right now. This, the two kids that were here were mine, obviously, and I have an older one that is about to be 18, my son. Some of the things that I was getting, and thank you for answering part of my question before I posted, because I'm glad to hear there's a change on the law trying to create a better environment, because I think dads more often than not get the short end of the stick. You make the assumption of this show that you were talking about. I don't really know what it is about, but you make the assumption right away that the dad was going to be out of the picture, period. Just the fact that they were coming apart, the dad's gone. Why should it be that way? Why is that assumption right away that a dad will be gone because a marriage comes to an end? You know, and sometimes, you know, that is actually being made a reality because, I'm trying to not to get lost in translation here, because society has got so accustomed to those assumptions, make things difficult for parents, for dads. You know, won't go into the details of my thing, but I like to think that I'm an involved dad, try to be as much as part of my kids, but I tell you, the last 6 years have not been easy. I have not custody of my kids, but my oldest child has been living with me for the last 2 years. When I want more time with my daughters, mom says, well, the custody says this. I say, well, you don't say anything about the custody when my son is living with me without that being part of the custody agreement. So I guess I echo a lot of what you say. It's tough, and I wish that as a society we will bring the rights of the fathers to the forefront and make it more clear that we are not different from moms. Right. We have our kids have a right to be with us as much as they have to have.
One thing I came across in research was that there seems to be a movement in Europe afoot that is far ahead of here in the United States, England in particular, when it comes to fathers' rights, that for some reason in the United States it's not picked up the steam as yet as what it has in England. So we have to wrap up here very shortly. This man in the gold shirt, I believe, yeah, no microphone, so we're going to have to hear you just with your voice. Go ahead. You're our last question.
My name is Larry Jones. I'm an internist, and I do emergency medicine work, too. I get to see what I'm telling you comes out of my observations. And I also have a program called What Men Must Do. About 15 years ago, some friends and I got together because we wanted to help put an end to some of this stuff that was going on. Stuff is a term that just is inclusive of all the chaos associated with what happens to kids and what happens to families. Everybody wanted to help children. But I said, you know, everybody wants children, but who's helping the men? In other words, in my search and research, personal research and empiric research on helping men, I have found some things that are just common to all groups of men that I have gotten involved with. Number one is they fear the idea to exert themselves as males. That's one thing. Number two is that most of them don't know what it means to be a man. And I mean even those of us who are educated, you know, we talk and we have sessions and we have discussions, and I'm amazed at what we don't know. And by the time we have our sessions are over, these guys linger on for 2 and 3 hours talking to each other. And I do this at churches, and the ministers tell me, you know, these men, you know, in churches, it's usually the females that show up, not the males, right? Well, these guys linger 2 and 3 hours because they hear stuff that makes them feel like they have a certain value. And I tell you, men in this country do not feel valued. And if we don't address that issue, I mean accept the issue, not address it, but accept the issue, because you can't address it until you accept it. It is shown through every phase of society now, and it is destructive. And I want to do anything I can to get in contact with anyone in this room, because I'm about to get busier, because my son's now 18, so I can now, you know, he can go on and I can do the things that I think are important in this realm.
One of the nice things about having these public conversations is the networking that can go on after they wrap up. So if some of you would like to stick around, and perhaps our panelists have a few extra minutes, if some members of the audience would like to come up and touch base with you, I appreciate it. All your comments and questions. I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody, but I want to give the panelists one opportunity to, just in a few seconds, to add anything that we haven't given you the opportunity to say this evening along these lines. Dr. Batar,
just,
go ahead.
You know, kind of talking, addressing a little bit of what you were speaking to, I think, is just that piece about a lot of dads that are absent were children at one point that were abandoned. And so just this intergenerational momentum that this problem has, so it's easy to pathologize the dad that's not as involved. But that dad was a child most likely at one point, and their dad, you know, there's some sort of attachment issue there. But yeah, I mean, that whole notion of how do you redefine what is being a man? What does that look like? Not having the role models and everything really kind of brings a lot of what we've been talking about, I think, all together. I do have to plug something real quick. Is that okay?
Go for it.
Because we do have a new community click, and I just realized I'm going way too far into this mic as I started watching y'all more. Y'all are kind of sitting back more. I'm like eating this thing here. So I'm just,
well, we all noticed it, but that's
okay. Right. Well, thanks for saying something. Jeez. But we have a community clinic. It's called the Pfeiffer Institute for Marriage and Family Therapy. It's been open for about a year. And we work on family issues, mental health issues, substance abuse issues. We don't turn anyone away due to their lack of being able to pay. Our students that are working on their master's degree there that provide the therapy, and they're supervised by doctorate-level clinicians. And so it's just a good, you know, if someone needs mental health services or substance abuse services or family services or help with divorce issues at a very low cost, then that's available. It's called the Pfeiffer Marriage and Family Therapy Clinic. So,
Your Honor, would you like to add some comments?
Not anything new, but I would just emphasize, as the gentleman said here, about the desire to be able to mentor and how to get more people involved, is I would just lift up to you again and just emphasize it, the importance of all of us to remember that these children, and while we're addressing whether it's women, men, family, spouses, all the other things that we're working on, it's still to realize that there are children who would love and need mentors, and to reach out and connect with other people and find resources that are available here to get connected to those young children, because making a difference in a young child's life is something that does not compare to most experiences that you would have. And so I just would encourage us to continue to focus on it.
Okay, Greg and then Reggie.
First of all, just thank you for coming out, and thank you for your energy and passion around this subject. Obviously, it's a very important to, you know, the children in our community and you know, around the country. I would just like to close with two thoughts. I did get my son a homework assignment last night, and I asked him what the three most things are in his eyes about being what a father can provide. And so I thought I'd, you know, kind of do a little research from a subject. And he said, number three, you don't have to be too strict. You have to be strict, but not unreasonably so. So, you know, and again, you know, I'm not going to sit here and go over each one of these topics, but it's important to set guidelines, but also be reasonable and respect them. Number two, and I thought this would be number one, but number two, spend time with their kids, have fun with their kids, and laugh. And that is probably the cornerstone of our relationship. And that just shows you how much of an impact it had on him. I mean, he gets that at age 12. And the number one thing he said that surprised me was support their kids' ideas. And I think that goes along to what you were saying, is just listen to them, accept them, love them. If I have, you know, anything that I've learned about being a father is you can't go wrong with loving your child too much. I think that is the key. When in doubt, love your child more than the right things, then all the dominoes fall into place. And the second point I guess I would make is this gentleman up here, mentioned about mentors, role models, things like that. And I don't really like to discuss this topic too much, but also if you don't have time to volunteer, you can also donate because there's a lot of agencies out there in the community that do a lot of great things that, that need support at this time. So consider that as far as, you know, helping us facilitate finding these mentors, matching, you know, doing our professional matching services and supporting the matches, because that's also a resource needed as well.
I would just add that in my experience, I found that your sincerity is probably your most important credential. And you being available, you know, you being reliable. So I think if you are sincere and if you're reliable, I think that can transcend any barrier, be it racial, gender, or whatever. Love can transcend anything. So the children are in need, and we can do all the analysis we want, but nothing is more important than the time that you can give. So I want to thank you all for your support and this very important subject.
How about a round of applause for Reggie Singleton, Greg Hood, the Honorable Ricky McCoy Mitchell, and Dr. George Bittard. And thank you to all of you for coming this evening. We appreciate your attention. This is something that's still fairly new to WFAE, so if you have any feedback, don't be afraid to offer, and we're still perfecting this too. So keep in mind, our next public conversation comes up in about a month. It's economic updates, where are we now? So as we like to say in radio, stay tuned for more details on that. So I've taken about 10 more minutes of your time tonight. If you happen to tune in 10 minutes late in the morning, I won't even say anything, so I'll pretend I didn't notice. So thank you all very much, and have a great night.